you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Let's change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. I'm your host, Mickey Desai. Today at the table with me, we have an old friend, Sharon Batch. How are you, Sharon?
I'm very well, Mickey, very well.
And Sharon is a partner with Batch Group Incorporated and author of an excellent book. What was the name of the book, Sharon?
From Chaos to Control, How to Build a High Performance Team.
I have read it. I'm ashamed to say I don't remember the title, but I remember the book being really good, and I've used that advice with some of my clients already.
Thank you.
So it's excellent stuff. And our other guest today, a new friend, Don Keel. Don is an author also and a retired development officer. How are you, Don?
How are you, Mickey? Good to be with you.
Definitely good to be with you. What's the name of your book?
Into the Field, Funding for Exploration.
Oh, very cool. And when I say retired development officer, what does that mean exactly?
Well, that means I've been in this business for about 50 years and vice president of a couple of private colleges and associate vice chancellor of a state university and that sort of thing.
Wow, that's quite a history. So,
well, I've been around the track a few times.
Excellent. Good stuff. So I know we're going to talk about, I have obviously an advanced look at our topics list for today. We're going to talk about undiscussables. How do we get started talking about the undiscussables? Is this going to be an expose of the things that nonprofits simply don't want to talk about?
Yes, actually it is. And I want to say that both Don and I are huge supporters of the nonprofit community. We've both worked in it for a very long time. And about a year ago, Don sent me an email, and it had to do with communicating or communicating with your donors. And based on that, we were talking about how to hear them, the response of court, several items like that. We talked for a full year until last January. We delivered a session called Donors for Life, How You Hear Them. And as we went through the conversation of how knowledge is created for a charity, our outcome came down to how donors perceive the charity receiving their gift. And then the final part of that was the undiscussables, things that charities don't like to talk about, but things that really impact on their ability to function successfully and meet all their needs in terms of, I guess, their clientele. I haven't yet talked to a charity that says, I don't need more money, but we've talked to lots of charities where the turnover is quite fantastic and the loss of good, solid knowledge is riveting. And I think it really has a negative impact. And Don can relate to this.
Sure, no doubt. I mean, my first reaction is, if you're a high-functioning nonprofit, you know the game of stewardship. You know what kind of transparency and relationship building needs to be fostered in order to have good donor relations. What could there possibly be that's undiscussable? So,
Don?
Well, Chris Argyris at Harvard coined the phrase back around 1980, and he was an organizational development guru, I guess, and you would say, and he wrote extensively about nonprofits and the fact that some of the biggest issues that they had were really never faced. And that the undiscussability of those things was also never focused on. And the lengths at which faculties, for example, would go to indirectly just bypass and deflect the real issues that were, that were impeding their progress. And we see that a lot in nonprofits. As an example, one of the most pervasive and kind of insidious termites in the foundation is the perpetuation of mediocrity, where you have leadership in the form of an executive director whose primary requirement, hiring requirement, is that the people being hired will not be a threat to that person's authority and confidence and that sort of thing. So the main agenda of that nonprofit becomes not necessarily achieving the maximum that it can achieve, but protecting the leadership and protecting all of those things that would be exposed were that modus operandi exposed, that sort of thing.
Definitely a good idea to shine a light on that kind of practice. And in my mind, I shouldn't be surprised. I know it happens, and yet I'm always surprised when I see it. You know, as someone who's letting ego get in the way of making good leadership decisions, we need to be shining a light on that and not letting that be an undiscussable. Good example. Thank you. Sharon, can you think of another one?
Well, because I work at the very bottom level of charities, and that's with their data, I have been writing about how data is managed since the time of old paper newsletters, and I still have copies of those. And my question was, what is your legacy? And in our practice with our clients, we've run a session called 4 days. And in other words, if everybody left your fund development department today, how would you continue to succeed? And what I found is there's very little emphasis on the data. It's almost like, well, we've got to get the dollars in. But the dollars are so dependent on those wonderful donors and working with them. And what I found in a lot of databases, they are empty. They're like old Mother Hubbard's cupboard. They are empty. They've got the gifts in there, but nothing else. They don't even have people that work for organizations that they're dealing with. And personally, I'm shocked at that. And I think a lot of that starts right at the top with somebody who really doesn't understand how important fundraising is, because in most charities, they depend on charitable gifts. So no dollars coming in means no budget. And or mediocre dollars coming in means just a little bit of the of their goals can be achieved. So I've found that to be very distracting, which, you know, made me write a book. And what techie writes a book? I mean, really, that was an excruciating experience. But I think that I think more can be done, and I think more needs to be expected from the donor side. It's all great to say, well, we've got all our reports for the federal governments, but ultimately, what's actually going on in there?
I mean, you say, who would want to read a book by a techie about their about the stuff that they don't do as relationship makers? But I thought the perspective was right on. If they're doing their jobs as good relationships managers, they should also have the data to back that up, for sure. So okay, we've got two good examples: leadership, mediocrity in leadership, and ineffective use and maintenance of databases. I'm wondering what we should talk about next. Is it wise to sit here and talk about more examples? Should we focus on one of these, or is there a broader base way to talk about how to help nonprofits address these inadequacies?
I don't know, Don, what do you think? I think
data is a good kind of an X-ray example, because it if you look, it's a dead giveaway about how an organization really operates. What am I talking about? Well, most of the problems that you have that are ascribed to data are not problems with the data at all. They're problems that have nothing to do whatsoever with the data. What am I talking about? Well, here's a recurring, as a friend of mine once said, a hardy perennial that pops up all the time in nonprofits. And that is that you see often when an organization converts to a new system, number one, the reasons they convert to the new system are suspect. Lots of times they don't need to convert to a new system at all, but incoming leadership wants to make a statement. And one of the things that demonstrates that someone is really with it and the Al-Quran, all that kind of stuff, is to put in a new system for handling your data. Well, what happens then? You see another recurring example, and that is that the staff that is implementing the change over to the new system and using it, the first thing they do is to try and make it behave like their old system. And so you get some very bizarre kinds of entries. My favorite one was a transition in the system that an organization I was working with was going through. And in looking it down and getting down under the hood with the system, you know, it as I say, is a dead giveaway. And we found one field that was very interesting, a field entitled checks deposited on Tuesday. And that's because one of the piles that staff person that was entering in, you know, into the system, one of the piles that she kept to track things were the checks that were deposited on Tuesday. So that became a field in this brand new multi-$1,000 hardware software system for an 18 branch association that was an utter disaster in the conversion, having nothing to do with the quality of the data or the system or the software. So I think that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, that ends up being discussed in a way which is totally irrelevant to the actual problem that's taking place.
Right.
If I can add to that, what I've seen are executive directors with no idea what the software does, taking advice from their staff. And what I found is that if the staff is inadequate, the first thing they blame is the software. And I just, I find that appalling. What it means is I don't want to learn. I don't want to take responsibility for what I do. I just want to find a scapegoat to deal with. And I think that's a huge issue as well. And I think part of that is executive directors that don't believe training is important. Guessing is the best way to do it. And, when you're talking about billions of dollars that go through the nonprofit sector, you've got to be kidding me. And as donors, I interviewed a couple of donors and high-end donors a couple of years ago out of my total frustration. This was pre-COVID. And one of the fellows told me, past chancellor of a university, just a really top-notch individual in our community, gave a big gift to an area. It was a small hospital rehab area. And found out that once they got the gift, he never heard from them again. He said it would have been nice to get a little note just on how things were going. And then he found out the whole department had left, or the major fundraisers. So he went in to talk to the ED. They couldn't tell him anything. I mean, would you give to an organization like that? I wouldn't waste a dollar on them. Right. But I think a lot of these organizations run like that. They run like they have no concept of how to work as a nonprofit business, if you want to look at it that way, and deal with their customers. Their customers are their donors.
And I think to further complicate the situation, you're talking about an industry where the average stay of a development officer is only 18 months.
And that's right.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because, it's every once in a while I check that. And the thing that has been interesting to me is that hasn't changed for the last 50 years. If you look back in the 70s, it was the same thing. And I think one of the biggest challenges to up and coming development people is the challenge of managing up. When you're a development officer in any kind of institution, the smaller, the more exaggerated it is, because you have to be chief cook and bottle washer and do all kinds of things. Whereas if in a larger institution, you're going to be like like an NFL football team, and your action is going to be much more specifically, oriented and narrowed. But you've got a lot of people stirring your pot with a long-handled spoon, and a lot of them are people you have to manage up to. They're the ED, they're the president of the college or the university, and they're the members of the board to whom the president or the CEO or the ED report to. So you got a lot of people stirring your pot with a long-handled spoon that actually is coming from upstairs. And it's very difficult for you. You can't just go in and say, hey, you don't know what you're doing. But that, in fact, is what happens in many cases. And so the artistry of development officers has to be to acknowledge the undiscussability of these things and to try and work with those people that are stirring their pot with a long-handled spoon. And if they can't get in the front door on an issue, they have to climb in through the bathroom window and try and deal with these things in an indirect way that is non-threatening and inoffensive to the people that they don't want to threaten or offend. And many times that ends in frustration. And I think that's a big contributor to the fact that the turnover rate has remained so small. I mean, the longevity has remained so small in these nonprofits.
I mean, I've got a couple different thoughts, but it's easier said than done to take the ego out of the equation, right? I mean, I think that's one
Absolutely.
Challenge that's in front of us. So that's one thing that I would like to talk about, and maybe that's a whole separate episode: the psychology of what it means to be in the position to not let your ego get in the way of you doing a good job. But what else do you think attributes? I mean, that 18th month time frame. Average stay. I'm shocked to hear you say it's been that way for multiple decades. I thought it was just a recent thing.
No.
So why do development officers only stay for 18 months?
I add to that? There was a big paper that was done a few years ago out of a group out of San Diego, mm-hmm. and they were I think it was called the Underdeveloped, and Their bottom line was that it's all about leadership. But, you know, I think there's so much more, because I have seen very lovely people that are a disaster at leadership. I mean, they couldn't organize themselves out of a paper bag if they chose to. And I think a lot of it has to do with very simple things. Disorganization. You know, when you look at all of the files that are stored on a server within a charity, they're everywhere. So one of the things that we've always suggested is the concept of a knowledge base, where it's kind of like going to a really good five-star dining room or kitchen. You don't go in there and find things everywhere. You find things where they should be so people can find them and use them. And I think that that kind of a concept needs to be part of a charity as well. Right. And what happens if you can find what you need, if you've got the information you need, you can do the job that you want to be doing rather than scrambling and going home feeling stressed and worried about meeting your goals. And when you meet your goals, you're going to get paid better. Because I do think charity people, fundraisers and everyone else that work there need to be paid well. And it all revolves around a disorganized, dysfunctional work environment.
So I do this seminar thing, this session that when I do some public speaking, I'll have a room full of people in front of me, and I'll divide the room into teams according to whatever tables they're at. And I'll say, okay, you have to pretend, each team has to pretend that you're the board of directors for a certain nonprofit. And then I give each table a 3-page summary, like a conditional status on the organization that they're being board members for. And it's everything from, okay, here's what your finances looks like. Here's what practices are going wrong. And when you read it, you realize that the organization is really going off the rails. Something is horribly wrong with what's happening with this organization. And my challenge to each of these teams is, let's chart out how you map your way away from disaster. And every team usually has a different solution based upon that table's expertise. The volunteer managers always say that you should fix the volunteer problems first. The finance people say you need to fix the books and the finance first. The people tend to start wherever it is they're at home.
Right.
Is that the same thing, what we're talking about? You know, does the same dynamic apply for fixing these undiscussables? Is it correct? Is it universally correct to say that we identify these problems and the only way away from them are to fix their databases and their leadership problems?
I'd like to answer that. And then Don, I know, will have a very well-qualified answer because of his experience. But I've asked this question. The charity itself, I don't know if there's even a solution for this, but the charity itself needs to have rules on how it functions, because board members don't necessarily understand charities and how they work. And it's not a case. And then, well, the finance area, you don't have a finance area unless you have money coming in. So it all revolves around the pot of gold that the charity can leverage. And it's the donors that help to support that. But in order for the charity to work successfully, they need to have rules. They need to have an ED that knows what's going on and has specific requirements. They need to have fund development people that have good job descriptions and are quizzed on how they're doing. And it needs to be a conversation within the organization, because every person in there plays a role. I've dropped beautiful clothes off at a charity. It's somebody that we work with occasionally. And the girl that at the front desk just said, oh, put them over there. Okay, fine. I phoned the ED and I said, you know, it's okay. I work with you folks, but I wouldn't want to see that with anyone else. Mm-hmm. They need to have an overall understanding of everything that's part of that charitable function. And it needs to start at the charity, because it's the charity that struggles when everybody else is quasi in what they're doing. But how do you do that? Is that even solvable?
Don?
Well, let me give you a real specific example of the kind of thing that that transcends all of the things that you might put on paper, the guidelines and the requirements and the accountability and all of these kinds of things that where the rubber meets the road tend to really influence how things get done or not get done. I worked with an organization which had a board chair who was a very famous guy. I guess that's all I should say about it. And a very household name in the Fortune 500 community and all that sort of thing. Well, I came on board to this organization, which was an interesting experience because unbeknownst to me, when I went to interview with this fellow, which was kind of wrapping up the series of job interviews, he basically told me I had nothing of substance on my resume and had no clue what I was talking about. And I had an absolutely miserable time with this guy. And the first thing I did when I left the interview, which was in one of the restaurants that he owned, I called the ED of the organization, which was a national association. I said, listen, hey, sorry, this is, you know, it's not going to work out. This guy's going to, he thinks I don't know what I'm talking about, et cetera, et cetera. She said, gee, I don't understand. Let me call his assistant and see what. In 5 minutes, I got a call back from the ED. He said, well, listen, I hope you're sitting down because you're not going to believe this, but I just talked to his assistant, his right-hand person, and he told me that he wished I had called him ahead of your interview with him because he conducts a stress interview and he tries to make you as miserable as possible to see how you're going to handle it. And so he called me up just now and the call took 30 seconds. He said, hey, it's a great guy. I think you ought to offer him the job. So this was the person that I was dealing with as the chairman of the board. So I got him going there, and then first thing he wanted to do when I got there was he said, listen, heck, I've got a great thing we're going to do here. It's going to raise a lot of money. We're going to send out a letter over my signature to all the Fortune 500 companies. It really wasn't all of them, but it was all the one that he purportedly, you know, had some connection with. And I'm going to write this letter and we're going to ask him for $1,000. We're going to have all these corporations that are going to pony up and give us $1,000. And that's going to give us a great floor of this year's giving. So I thought to myself, that's not going to work. You know, you can't raise money in the corporate community just with a, you know, blank letter like that, unless there is, you know, something more of a relationship that's played upon. But he, you know, there's no point in arguing with this guy. So he went ahead and we sent out all these hundreds of $1,000 requests over his signature. And you know how much it raised? Zippo. Not $1.
My now, goodness.
His conclusion was not that this strategy was bonkers. His conclusion was that the case for support for that organization was not strong in the corporate community. So what we had to do was play by those rules of his perceptions of things and climb in through the bathroom window in order to get him to do something which would demonstrate to him that it was successful in generated results. And then he was encouraged by his own successes to continue to do the good strategy and to forget about the bad. So fortunately, the letter to all these corporations was not something that we would have done anyway. So nothing was really lost except a bunch of postage and so forth, you know, right. Envelopes and such. That's not anything we ever would have done. So nothing was lost. And we managed to redirect him in the ways that he could use his, you know, influence and his fundraising, you know, potential to the good or for the audience, you know, to the good of the organization. So that's an example where something which is totally You mentioned the ego before, you know, the issue of ego. Well, there's an example where the ego was the entire issue, which, of course, could not be dealt with head on and resulted in a totally disastrous result. But the good thing was it was something that we wouldn't have done anyway. And we managed to rechannel his attention in a direction where he could be successful. So that's just an example of the ego and the undiscussable, and you know how you have to handle that, which isn't in any fundraising textbook anywhere.
No.
Right. Now you've given me an idea for a book.
It'll be a good one.
How to do that? Yes. How do you get that? We should write. We should write the undiscussable fundraising handbook.
We should. We should.
It would be fun. Yeah, it would be fun.
I think there'd be lots of, I don't know how many people would really be interested in reading it simply because this is not what people want to hear. They want to hear, oh, how to make hundreds and thousands of dollars in your major right. gift campaign. You go to these conferences, there's never any depth to anything. It's all the fluffy stuff.
It's all the fluffy stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it's all the fluffy stuff.
As long as we're off of on this tangent here, I will say, though, that maybe the title will make the difference. And the title can be something juicy like, what's your nonprofit not talking about?
And yeah, that's maybe, a good one.
I don't
that's
know, something like that. But
and a book could be taken home and read by yourself. Yeah. You know? It's not something that has to surface where someone is exposed as acknowledging exactly. that they're talking about this stuff. You know?
It could be like that book on that movie, The Help, where they read it and go, that's me.
So if anyone scoops this idea and writes this book, I'm going to be very angry. No, go for it. Yeah.
I think another issue is fundraising or the executive directors that don't want to deal with what the software is. We've been dealing with one executive director. I keep saying, would you like to see what the software does so that if you do make a change, you actually know what you're losing? Oh, no. We're going to let other people. And oftentimes what I love is we've done an assessment. Well, who did the assessment? Nobody there knows what's going on. So, I mean, you know, at some point you've got to ask yourself who makes these decisions and how is it done? And is it actually based on facts or just assumptions? And, you know. It's a scary thing because they do a lot of really good work and they could do more in a less stressful environment if they ran more effectively.
Don, in your notes, you said to hear that that the disconnect largely lies with technology in general. And does that apply to all of these undiscussable situations we've touched on today? Because I know there are many other undiscussable situations that nonprofits see with regard to both their leadership and their data. Does it always come back to technology?
Oh, no. No, I'll tell you what it always does come back to is personalities. Mm-hmm. It always comes back to the human dimension. And I'll give you an extreme example, which I've seen repeated only twice. And that is, and it can be so extreme that if the issue is presented head on, the person that is on the receiving end of that message does not even acknowledge that the subject has been raised. And when that message is finished, the person proceeds as if the person that is talking to him had not said anything.
That's some incredibly strong denial.
Well, it's amazing to witness. I can tell you that. I mean, I was absolutely floored. In one case, I was the person delivering the message. Mm. And I was talking to the vice president of a major university who had a bunch of shenanigans going on. He was trying to manage up, you know, and what he had was a problem because a person that was on his staff, her brother was on the board of trustees of the university. Ooh. So she was operating as a privileged person, not subject to the rules or accountability or anything of the rest of the people on the staff, on the development staff, and was just, you know, functioning as a Vatican, you know, in the middle of a country. Mm-hmm. And so he was having a hard time dealing with this. Well, in my, you know, getting to know people, I found all this out and everything, what was going on and everything. And so now he had the compounded problem that she was bucking for a job, which was higher up than her current position, and for which he had a number of better candidates. When I surfaced this with the guy and said, what are you going to do with this? Is this position now wired? Are you going to have to hire this person? Her brother's on the board of trustees. I know he's leaning on you to, you know, put her in this position. And he sat there with a Buddha smile on his face. And when I finished the question, he didn't answer. He started at the point of which before I had asked him the question. He continued the conversation as if there had been a gap of that period of time in which I had surfaced that issue with him and asked him to come.
Oh, you've gone mute.
Yeah, he just went absolutely. And this happened again in another situation of even larger proportion, which had to do with the president of a 9-campus state university. And this president would not do certain things. And that issue was surfaced. How can we get the president to do X with his right-hand guy, the executive vice president of the university? And the same thing happened. The question was not even acknowledged, as it had not even been given. So that's an extreme example of just how undiscussable some of these things can be, you know, and it all depends on who can tolerate to hear what, you know, and some people, they just can't do it. Psychologically, can't do it.
Right, right. There's so much here to continue to talk about. I don't think it's possible for us to nail this down to the short Snapcast format that I like. Can I propose that we wrap this episode here and come back for episode 2 in a few weeks and continue to talk about, I don't know, maybe we get a little more granular with specific situations and maybe suggested remedies for those situations. What do you think?
Oh, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I'd be game for that. Absolutely.
Let's do that. So Sharon, Don, thank you guys again. It's always good to see you, Sharon. And Don, thank you for being our new friend today on the Snapcast. We will come back and do episode 2 here in a couple weeks, maybe 3 weeks. In the meantime, if folks wanted to learn more about what you do and maybe be in contact with you, I always ask, how do people find you? Don?
Email donskeel@me.com.
Me.com. Got it. And Sharon?
They can go on to www.raisefundswithease.guru and connect with us there.
Fantastic stuff. And Don, I'm going to try to get a copy of your book in the meantime. Maybe we should talk about that at some point as well. But again, thank you. I think this is fascinating stuff. And I think it's, you know, if we can get nonprofits to address their unmentionables, their undiscussables, their unmentionables, that's different.
Look under
that's,
the skirt.
Yeah, right.
paging Dr. Freud, speaking of psychology. So, but yes, we'll definitely do an episode 2, maybe even an episode 3, who knows, but I'll be looking forward to whatever comes next. Thanks you guys. All thanks right. Very much.
Great. And
thanks,
thank
Mickey.
You.
Nice have chatting.
A- Absolutely.
This has been The Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.
The Snapcast is a production of the Nonprofit Snapshot. Please visit us at nonprofitsnapshot.org to learn more about our consulting work and the ways we can help your organization continue to make the world a better place.